Hey guys, welcome to our newest episode of Untucked. Today we are going to talk about investing at all-time highs and some of the kind of commentary and considerations around that. And then we're going to discuss budgeting for and paying for vacations. Thanks for listening. The opinions expressed on this podcast are our own and do not reflect the opinions or views of FC Advisory, the Financial Coach Group, or the New Wealth Project. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be interpreted as investment advice. Welcome to episode 99 of Untucked. This is Megan.
Mike here.
This is Jeff. Pet food companies employ human taste testers.
It's gross.
It's pretty gross, right? Like they actually eat the food. You both have confused looks on.
I'm just thinking about what's the alternative. Like you have a cat and then you're trying to gauge whether the cat really likes it or really doesn't.
Why are there any?
So you think they should use a cat try dog food and to get the cat's opinion on the dog food?
But why do we need food testers for
It wouldn't work for dogs. Dogs will eat anything no matter how bad it tastes. So You couldn't.
Guys, why do we need taste testers for animal food?
So apparently like the smell has a lot to do with if an animal wants to eat it or not. So they smell it first.
The humans.
Because if it smells awful, then the pet probably won't eat it. They taste it for taste value and then also test it for like nutritional value.
At what point in like a new dating relationship does that come out in terms of like what
you do? That's a great question.
Yeah, do you think people have it on like their Tinder profile occupation?
Pet food taste tester. What do you think that they make?
Could you imagine making out with somebody after they ate dog food?
No, I don't think they actually like ingest the food. They just taste it and then probably spit it out.
Are you surmising this or
No, it's truth. But still, it's pretty gross, right?
My comment still stands.
But what do you think that they make a year?
I would do it for no less than six figures.
Free food for their pets? Let's say it's a cat lady and she has like 12 of them.
It's like 35 grand a year.
Yeah.
Up to like maybe like 100 grand.
Is that also part of the fun fact?
Yep.
Oh, cool.
There's no way I would do it for 100 grand. I don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. Yeah.
For everything you guys just mentioned. Like, you'd have to change your Tinder profile. You have to lie on your Tinder profile.
Okay.
All right. Good one.
Thanks, Mike.
Where do we want to start with sports?
I mean, Phillies are in the middle of the sixth inning right now.
Yeah, I think this is our first Phillies pod.
Sorry, check me. Bottom of the sixth, Phillies are up 4-2 on the Cardinals. Phillies are in an okay spot in the NL East. They're behind the Braves by 2.5 games. They're about a game out of the wild card as we speak. Standard start of the year slow. Almost getting swept by the Braves in their first series. Feels like a lot of the same with the Phils. Like we need Trey Turner to hit. We need our bullpen to actually like close out a game. So that's got me a little concerned that I feel like a lot of the same issues are still there. Like Nick Castellanos is still swinging at pitches that are nowhere near the strike zone. Now, we're 11 games in, so we have about another 148 left. But I'm hopeful that, you know, they'll improve. They'll start to come around. Zach Wheeler looks awesome. You guys have nothing for me. Zero.
Haven't watched anything.
Yeah, same here.
I mean, it's April. Who cares?
Will you care when it's a red October?
Yeah, like I said, I'll do the same thing. If they're in the playoffs.
Playoffs.
I'll, yeah.
Round one, you'll.
I may go to round one now from now on instead of just the NLCS.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even if it's like a wild card round.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Good. Good, good.
Okay. All right.
Thank you guys for paying attention, being part of that conversation.
Do we go Flyers?
Yeah. No, there's epic.
Touchy subject.
Epic collapse. You know, whatever. 2 weeks ago or so, they were, I don't know, their playoff odds were, I'm guessing, I would say it's probably like 80%.
What's it now?
It's got to be like 3%. I think there's mathematically maybe a chance, but it's not on them. It depends on, there's only three games left, but they're done. Epic, epic collapse. Really puts a final bad dent in a season that otherwise had a lot of good things to say about. Their goaltending just absolutely couldn't have been worse in these last 10 days. And the team in front of them is nowhere near good enough to make up for, you know, a guy who lets in 4 goals on 9 shots to start the game or whatever. And not good. And from far out kind of too. Like, it was really tough to watch.
They've lost to a lot of bad teams. Recently.
All bad teams, in fact. They're like the last 7 games, all bad teams. But
I was at that Blackhawks game.
Yeah, that's right. You were. That was a bad one.
Bad. They lost 5-2.
Yeah.
They were never in the game.
Exactly. If they made it to the playoffs, it was going to be an early exit, which would have been fun to watch around. But anyway, kind of the season ended up, all when it's all said and done, probably pretty close to what was expected to begin with. Missed the playoffs, middle of the pack draft pick. I don't know.
I'm more interested in your take on Tortorella's comments like last week. I forget which game it was. It may have been the game or two after the Blackhawks game where he just said...
Called him soft?
Yeah, pretty much like to the effect that there's some guys out there that don't know what they're doing, mm-hmm. that are soft, that are not giving it their all, that basically just have given up.
Yeah, he...
He said, not everybody.
He was pretty good in all. I watched all of his post-game press conferences, even if I had to, like, watch it later, because I was curious to hear what he was going to say. He was very – he really did not throw them under the bus much at all, other than that, what you're talking about, Jeff, that game. Everything else, he was like, hey, we didn't play badly. We just didn't get – you know, he was untorts-like in a lot of them, because I thought he was going to lose his mind. But, I mean, he took this as an opportunity to evaluate guys in games that are important, playoff-like, not definitely not playoff, but close. And I think he didn't like what he saw, to your point, in a few guys. So,
you know. I appreciate that as a fan. I appreciate him saying that.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. He acknowledged too, which I think the problem was, they were out of gas as a team. Their defense was completely... They couldn't even put one skate in front of the other, relying on two AHL guys who have never played in the NHL before for a handful of these games. That just – it would have been actually surprising had they – in hindsight, had they actually made it. You know, and the competition, the other teams that they're, like, vying for in the standings are also just as bad. They can't win either. So it wasn't like – you know, the Penguins, I shouldn't use them. It wasn't like the Caps or the Red Wings just made this incredible run and, you know, went 8-0 or anything. But anyway, it's but my question to you is, was the Birds collapse worse than this?
Oh God, yeah.
Because the expectations were much higher.
Not even a question.
I didn't know about the Flyers collapse until today. But yeah. I think the Birds' expectations were very, very high.
One of the most epic collapses in NFL history, dude. They were 10-1. Yeah. I don't even want to get started. I'm going to lose my mind.
So anyway, that's it for the Flyers. There's nothing more to say. The season's over, and some good, some eh. They need a top tier defenseman. That's clear. I don't know where they're gonna get it, because that's really hard to win in this league without an absolute stud number one defenseman who can run the power play and, you know, move the puck and all that. So that's, to me, that's their biggest issue.
Okay. Sixers on a bit of a tear, huh?
Yeah, they're situated in the seventh seed. Things were pretty bad with Joe hurt, so they're limping into a playoff spot.
Top eight go? Top 10.
Top 10, because they have the play-in tournament now. So 7 and 8 play each other, and then 9 and 10 play each other, and the winners of those get the respective 7 and 8 seeds. So it's still 8 teams ultimately, but they have the play-in tournament.
But 6 in a row.
Yeah, they've had a nice little run, a couple of games right before Joe came back that they really had no business winning, but got them, and then had a couple where he didn't play since he's been back that they were able to get some wins. So,
and he looks pretty good.
Yeah, you know, he looks like he's in way better shape than I expected. The first game back, I was actually there, and you could see, I mean, there were a couple of times he was calling for a sub and, you know, ready to get off. But he seemed to get back into, like, up and down the floor pretty well. And the things that typically slow down, like your shots are short, you know, you don't have enough on the ball. That doesn't really seem to be a problem for him right now. So we'll see. I mean, I like them at mostly full strength against a lot of teams in the East, even with the exception of Boston. You know, if they can avoid Boston, they can maybe get a couple of wins. Other teams are banged up too, so I don't know. I'm very cautiously optimistic, but with him missing as much time as he has, you know, if they win a series, that's probably over. You know, performing better than I expected.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. So today for Coach's Corner, we are going to refer to an article written by Ben Carlson called "What If You Only Invested at Market Peaks." A common question we get from clients is, when is the best time to invest? When things are going well and markets are hitting all-time highs, there's often apprehension of putting money into the market because of the possibility it goes down shortly thereafter. There's been a lot of work done to support the fact that investing when they have the money, regardless of market environments, is the best time to do so. But as humans, our emotions don't always adhere to those facts.
Yeah, I think that we have just been hearing this a lot lately, talking to clients, talking to prospective clients about, like, investing money if they have money. And they're just super, everyone seems to be apprehensive about, why would I do it now? Like, it's at an all-time high. And it just seems like such a goofy comment or thing for them to say when dollar cost averaging is not the preferred method, like, from a mathematical standpoint. From a history standpoint. Now, you might get lucky, but, like, if you have money, $100,000 that you want to invest, 9 times out of 10 is not in your favor to dollar cost average 10 grand in over the next 10 months. You're better off investing it right away, all of it, because we know the longer your money's invested, the better chance it has to do. And people just don't wrap their brain around that for some reason. And this is the same thing. It's mm-hmm. like, if I have money and I have a long-term perspective, it doesn't matter where the market is right now. Because if I'm investing for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, you're better off investing now. So it doesn't matter where it is, unless there's a short time frame for when that money's needed.
Right.
And that's what I don't think people get. Like, if you have the $100,000 or $10,000, is that earmarked for something? No, it's earmarked for my retirement. well, then it should go in right now. I don't care if the S&P's at 5,200, because 10 years from now, it's going to be higher than that. 15 years, it's going to be higher than that. 20 years, it's going to be higher than that. I mean, the number that he references in his article, let me find it. Like, it's just wild. And it's the one that really stuck with me on this chart. Like, because I can remember very vividly, I can't remember 1987. I wasn't investing in 1987. But I can certainly remember March of 2000. And I can certainly remember October of 2007. And if you invested in March of 2000, you immediately lost 50% of your money. But now 20 years later, your money's 220% more. Like, that's just crazy. Like, I bet nobody would believe that.
Assuming you stayed invested over that whole
time. Assuming you stayed invested and didn't freak out over that 20-year period.
Yeah.
23-year period at any point.
Right.
Because then all bets are off. But even 07, like if you invested in October of 07, you immediately lost 57%. That's crazy. But 10 years later, you have 105% more money than you did when you started.
And that's the concern people have, right? When they are making these decisions, is that at all-time highs, immediately there becomes, right, a new data point on this chart. And that's kind of the emotional obstacle you have to get around, which is what you're describing. The reality of the time frame in front of you is going to benefit you more by getting the money invested. But looking at this data, there's going to be a lot of people who say, well, I'd rather have less on the, you know, at the long, at the end of that than see my money cut in half immediately.
Yeah, and I think my comment about dollar cost averaging has probably got a lot of people saying, like, I'm wrong and I'm an idiot. But most time frames, the market is up. If you just happen to decide not to dollar cost average in one of those rare instances when the market goes down, yes, you would have been better off dollar cost average.
Right.
But most times you won't be. You will be better off getting it invested now. And like, don't even look at it. Who cares? Mm-hmm. If you don't need it right now, you don't need it 5 years from now, you don't need it 10 years from now, then don't even look at it. And don't even try to go back and calculate which scenario would have made you better off.
Yeah, so the recent one that's kind of, you know, within memory for a lot of people is the 2000s, right? So you had the internet and tech thing, which kind of peaked in March of 2000, and then there was a subsequent basically cut in half.
I'm talking about the S&P 500 in this case. And then remember, so in 2000 and 2001, 2002 were all down years. And then if you held on, you clawed your way back, but then you had to deal with 2007 and 2008, which was another, you know, 50%+ decline. So by the time you get to 2010, that decade, you're not even, you're barely underwater, but you're not quite back to where you started. So like, incredibly painful 10 years.
Yeah.
When it's all said and done. And by the way, that's an example of what would happen over 10 years, maybe 5 out of 100 times. Like, it's rare.
I mean, they coined it like the lost decade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you have more than 10 years to work with at that time, so let's say you had 20 years, the numbers right here, you would have made 219% on your money when that next decade was said and done. So the point about, like, if you have any time frame at all to work with, you shouldn't care at all about the level of the market. And on the flip side, you know, we know people that, you know, the S&P got back to an all-time high in 2013 or 14, I want to say, recovering from the financial crisis and all that. Well, it's at an all-time high, and people are saying, well, it's an all-time high. I'm going to wait for it to pull back. Well, what's happened from that point in time, 2014-ish, to
where
now?
Was it? Where was
the S&P it? Was at like 2,100, yeah, or something like
it's
that.
It's doubled, more than doubled.
It's more than, way more than doubled since then, way more. So it's more than, it's psychological, but it's also like, I think a lot of times we hear people say, well, it's at an all-time high. We're just going to wait until it like pulls back a bit. and then we'll get in. Well, in that case, you never got in.
Right.
Ever. Or, not, yeah, you sat there for 9 years, 10 years, and you're still sitting there with what you had in cash.
Yeah.
And you will never get those returns back.
And I also challenge that because of the emotional element of it, meaning we're going to wait till things pull back. Oh, and then we're going to be able to convince you to get in, right? When shit starts to hit the fan and there's some other thing, a pandemic, something, an election year, whatever it is, something else that we're dealing with in the markets or in the country or in the economy. And at that point, you're going to say, oh, now's a good time. Mm. I mean, we don't work like that. Humans don't operate that way. And the people who are saying, yes, that's exactly when I would do it. Look, okay, 1 out of 100 maybe end up pulling that trigger.
Yeah.
But the environment becomes scarier and you're then going to deploy your money. It's just way less likely.
It's like, I mean, maybe this is a bad analogy, but it would be like if you're buying a house and real estate prices are at an all-time high, which they often are. I mean, you kind of don't say, I'm assuming you can afford the house, right?
Right.
You don't say, well, I'm going to wait for a little pullback here.
Right.
You know, why? Because you kind of know that over time, the price of your house is going to be higher than it is than now, even if it's an all-time high price, right?
I mean, maybe not a year later.
Yeah.
But when you go to sell it 10, 15 years from now or longer, it's going to be worth more.
Yeah.
Just like investments. Yeah. So if you're not buying your house now with the intent to sell it 6 months or a year later, then yeah, you're going to make, it's going to be worth more. I don't want to say you're going to make money on it.
Right.
It's going to be worth more. And I'm obviously like, if the decisions are put it all in now, I don't want to do that, dollar cost average or never invest it. Yeah. Obviously dollar cost average.
Sure.
If that makes you feel better, if that will get you in the market over some time frame, absolutely do that. But certainly do not sit on the sidelines and wait until you think there's a pullback happening.
Yeah. And the math behind the dollar cost averaging is pretty simple. It's basically if you're buying in every month, let's say 6 out of 10 months, the markets are up. And I'm making that up, but it's kind of close to that. So by that logic, you're going to be paying higher prices 6 out of 10 times and not 4 out of 10 times. So
it makes perfect sense, man. And I didn't even understand that until I was going through the CFP curriculum. And they're like, yep, dollar cost averaging is not more favorable in most cases than just investing. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like we've been told all of our lives that dollar cost averaging is the way, but it's so simple. Like when you think about if the market's up 13% this year, and you're going to invest $12,000 in the market that year, you're better off putting all 12 grand in January to get the full 13% return versus doing $1,000 a month. Mm-hmm. I was blown away, like totally opened my eyes. I was blown away by it.
I think your point's a good one though. We can probably end there that like, if it means doing nothing, then dollar cost averaging is good and serviceable. But if you're debating between the advantages or disadvantages of kind of a lump sum investing in an all-time high market, do it. Just get in.
Yep.
Cool. Want to talk about vacations?
this, all right, what do we got? Stall process caused me a lot of stress.
So the article is from artofmanliness.com. Nice. That pretty much tells you all we need to know.
Is that like my personal diary?
It's written by Brett and Kate McKay, and it's titled, How Much Should You Spend on a Vacation? We came across this article, which offers guidance in thinking about affording your next vacation. And while we may not necessarily agree with the suggestions, we thought it would be an interesting topic to discuss. So what they attempt to do in the article is essentially give a range of which your income can or should responsibly be attributed to a budget. The range that they use is 5 to 10% of your net income. We all read that and kind of reacted like it's never been a way we've thought about budgeting for or paying for vacations. So I don't know that we need to pick on the art of manliness, maybe we can just talk a little bit more about our processes in planning for and paying for vacations.
Yeah, I wouldn't pick on them because at least they have a process, right? Like they have a formula. Like I don't have a formula. I probably should have a formula for vacation spending. It's always just been like, oh my God, we need a vacation. Okay, where can we afford to go? And that way we won't just like be bankrupt after we went there, which is why we've never gone to Disney World.
Well, that's a good move, in my opinion.
Right, and those discussions are different if it's like just you and Melissa versus if it's all six of you.
Right, like if you saw like the way we do vacations as a family, people would probably think if they don't think we're crazy already, they'd probably think we're crazy. Because with six people, it's so expensive to go anywhere. If you're flying, and then with six people, if you're staying in a hotel, like you can't just get a double bed with a cot. Do you know what I mean? Right? Like, because then you're tripping over everyone's suitcases. The boys have piles of clothes. I'm ranting right now. All of it. Like, so it's just, our methodology as a family has been, okay, like, where do we want to go in the next 12 months? When do we want to go? And try to build that trip, I don't want to say as cheap as possible, but to be mindful of the cost. Like, we don't want to, like, skimp on everything, but, like, okay, like, how can we navigate our flights so that we're not getting gorged? How are we going to work the hotel situation? Are we going to do, like, a suite? Because that'll accommodate all of us, and that's cheaper than doing two rooms. Or do we want to, has it been a tight year, and do we want to all cram into one room? Which, again, we've had that thought process and executed on that thought process before. Because we're like, yeah, we're not going to be in the room that much. We're going to be out in the, like, in the resort and at the pool. And then, like, all six of us come back from the pool, and it's just a complete nightmare. So that's our horrible way of coming up with our vacation budget.
And then do you just estimate what that'll all cost and it becomes a line item each month leading up to that point?
Yes.
Okay. So
and Melissa does that. Like, yeah, I know. She'll budget for most of the trip, like pretty much like travel.
Okay.
Like she'll budget for the flights, the hotel, and that kind of stuff. And then I just kind of have in the back of my mind, okay, we're going to be there for 5 or 6 days. That's probably between food and drink. That's probably going to run us another like $17,000. So I'll try to plan, make sure my credit card is lower that month, so that, or I build that into my like my credit card spending that month.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know, but the budgeting for vacation and tying it to income is foreign to me. Back to that, and I think most people just kind of like, I don't know, maybe they want to do like one big trip a year and another smaller one. I don't know how people do it, but it's more the eye test in a way, or this, it's kind of like, all right, what are flights running? Like, we want to do this. And then what hotel, like, do we have credit card points maybe to use? Do we have miles? I just have never gone to as far as, here is our budget, our vacation budget. It's a hard line number. That's just not how we do it. Again, probably to a fault, but because we've done a lot of them where they were kind of unplanned or certainly not well in advance. Because we're not big, like, map out the year people and here's what we're doing, unless it's something like significant. And, you know, I mean, that's it. I don't know. I haven't done the math. I would be curious to see how that ultimately did tie back into like this the percentage of net income thing. I have a feeling it's blowing way past that. yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, but you're probably right. Given your lack of planning for your vacation budget, yeah, you're probably over budget this article.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been situations that are like trips or expenditures that are maybe not mine. Like if, you know, you're going on a bachelorette party or you're traveling for a wedding, that like are harder to plan for, even with time, because there's just like some unknowns about it. But if I'm planning a trip, there's no like percentage of my income that's really driving my affordability. It's probably a little bit of what you're describing, Mike, like the eye test. Like, does this flight, does this hotel, does my expected spending feel egregious? Right. Or does it feel like something I can afford to pull off? Every month, because I travel like pretty frequently, every month I do allocate a certain amount of dollars to travel. It's rarely tied to a particular trip, but it gives me a little bit of a buffer that if something presents itself, I can go to it and it doesn't mess up my normal cash flow.
Okay.
Or if I know then that a big trip is coming, then that becomes, you know, maybe the deposits I'm paying or the flights that I have to buy in a timely manner. So it gives me some flexibility to not have to feel like I need to lay out the entire year, because I don't really operate that way either. But if someone presented me a trip that was a number that I was like totally uncomfortable with, I just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. So we will have like a thought process like, hey, let's take the kids skiing. Well, that's going to cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So then we're like, hey, like if I say in June, I want to take the kids skiing this winter, then we know that, all right, we have to build a budget for that. And I like your way of doing that. Like, all right, let's put $500 away a month. That's going to be our budget for the ski trip. So we have to do that when it comes to kind of if the whole family's going somewhere. If it's not, if it's just Melissa and I doing like a 3-day trip somewhere, we can probably pull that off.
Yeah.
But any kind of like legitimate vacation, we have to think of it in advance and we have to allocate dollars per month towards that. But and Melissa does it that way. I don't participate in that, but I probably should. Meaning like I should probably start to, out of my section of our budget, start to allocate some dollars towards vacation.
So when you allocate dollars in that way for something like this, is that because you want to compartmentalize it so that it's not spent on other things? If it's just in your, like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, of course.
Is that solely the reason?
I see Melissa's vacation account here, and then I watch like money get journaled out of it into her regular spending account and then journaled back in. So it kind of becomes like her survival account as well. And she she's got a whole system of workbooks that she chicken scratches in every freaking week. Like, you just, it's the most ridiculous form of accounting you've ever seen in your life. But yeah, because that way, like, we know, look, we're renting a place down the shore this summer for 2 weeks. That's not cheap. So we need to allocate dollars towards that every month so that when that shows up, yep, they want their half of their deposit in February. We got to give them that. And then in June, they need the other. So yeah, I mean, we have, otherwise it'll probably get gobbled up with car repairs or whatever else, man.
Yeah. I think for me, it's definitely partially that, like just the compartmentalization. But it's also like when we went to Africa, for example, I booked, because I travel often with friends in kind of a group, and I booked, like, I paid the deposit on our Airbnb, the deposit on our safari, and booked flights. So it's like not all my money, or it was all my money. It's not all that I owe, but having that buffer allows me to cover that piece of it, so that we can keep all of our group planning together. So I feel like it allows for a little bit more of an organized approach, at least in the way my friends and I have put trips together and traveled. So I have, like, when my credit card comes in after doing all of that, I have my normal credit card spending, and then I have something to cover what is going to be the overage. So it's more just seeing it a little bit separate makes me feel more confident that when the bigger bill comes in, I'll be able to handle it.
Yeah, okay.
I think ideally what people should do is at some point, doesn't have to be December or January, but I think the most responsible thing to do is map out your year. Okay, obviously it doesn't have to be every little trip that you're doing, sure, like the little ones, but like if you have three, like a summer vacation, you're gonna get away in the winter and you're gonna maybe take like a long weekend with your spouse, like you should map them out in the beginning of the year, estimate kind of ballpark, doesn't have to be exact, costs, and then build it into the budget, man. Not maybe as a percentage, but like, hey, this is what we want to do this year. This travel budget's probably going to run us 15 grand for the year. So we need to start socking away like 800 to 1,000 bucks a month so that we can pull that off pretty easily.
Yeah. I think coming up with a number is like the most maybe important. Like just the number is going to be 15. And like, how does that fit into how we do this? Because that means 15 grand doesn't get spent
somewhere else.
And, you know, in our experience, like that somewhere else sometimes ends up being credit cards, right? Because 15 grand was unaffordable. Like, and the article I think talks about this, like ideally you're not financing vacations, right? You're not taking a trip in June that you're still paying off the following June. So like the affordability, whether it's a percentage of your income or just a number that you and your spouse, your family agrees is comfortable, then pay for it. Don't
you can't borrow debt and interest. You can't borrow your vacation.
I mean, I've literally had conversations with people who are like, this is paying off X, like a trip I took, you know, 6-8 months ago. Like, so it happens, unfortunately.
But how? Like, you can't borrow from a bank.
Put it on a credit card.
Yeah, but like that, like you can't do that. Like,
right.
That's
right.
An absolute hard no. Like,
yes.
You don't have to pay cash for a car if you can finance it at 2.5%. You don't have to pay cash for your furniture if you're getting it from Raymour and Flanagan at 0% down for, you know, two or 3 years. But if you're taking a trip, the Airbnb needs to be paid and you can't finance it on a credit card at 25, 30%.
Okay.
Cool.
All right.
Let's go to our top five. And we did the opposite of this a couple of pods ago. So today we're going to do top five best sports logos. I hope I'm not like contradicting myself.
Really? I thought the same thing.
Like I was like, I should go back and find what my five were.
I think it's awesome if you didn't.
I would hope I didn't.
No,
but
like if you didn't go back and check.
I didn't because I couldn't find my little thing and I wasn't going to listen to our podcast. Okay. Are you kidding me? So hopefully, if anyone remembers, don't call me out. I'll go first.
Yeah, please do.
The first one I have, I hope it applies, the old Raptors logo. So it's not their current logo.
What's their old one?
Their old one, yeah.
Like the one from like Vince Carter.
Like it like had an actual raptor on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was okay. It was kind of like a cartoon raptor.
Yeah, but it's just not the current one they use, so I wasn't sure if that was allowed.
Okay.
I think when we did like best, we did something else and I used that before. I hope it was best, not worst. The San Antonio Spurs.
The spur?
They have an actual spur.
Oh my God, it's terrible. It's terrible.
All right. You're the Kansas City Royals. The KC with the crown on top. I think it looks pretty dope. The Raiders, Las Vegas Raiders.
Okay. It's kind of iconic.
Yeah, I like that one. And then
not the old Oakland Raiders?
Isn't it the same?
They didn't change the logo?
No.
Okay,
no.
So it's same. Like the dude same. With the
pirate.
Patch.
It's like a pirate.
Patch, okay. Yeah. And then I have the Miami Heat.
Mm. Okay, yeah. That's my debatable for my fifth. I'm not really sure yet.
Okay. No other overlap, though?
No.
I don't have an overlap, but I kind of do. So I actually had the Raptors.
Really?
But the new one.
Okay,
interesting.
Kurt. Okay.
Because I think it's cool, the basketball with the talons or whatever you call them.
Yeah it is cool.
Yeah, I think they did a good job.
You two on the same page.
I have an obscure one.
It's got to be top four sports, dude.
What?
It's got to be one of the four majors, right?
Yeah, but an obscure team / logo.
Gotcha.
It's the Milwaukee Brewers. Good color scheme, like purple and gold or whatever. But they have like a baseball glove, but it's an M and a B with a baseball in there. Like it's sort of clever. I don't know. I thought it was good.
Okay.
And then I've got the Jeff, you're going to disagree, but I think the Flyers logo is great.
It's terrible.
It's great.
It's so bad.
It's a P. It's orange wings. Puck in the middle, and it's flying. It's yeah, it's so it's
stupid.
Flying.
It's stupid.
I think that was on your worst.
Yeah, I think probably. It was.
Yeah.
Sticking with the old Hartford Whalers is just classic. It's why they still sell the now Carolina Hurricanes franchise. It's why they still sell a ton of Hartford Whalers like T-shirts and stuff. It's the W and the whale tail on the top, and that makes an H in the middle. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's a cool one.
And good colors, too.
I actually don't like the colors, but I do like the
logo. Really? And then lastly, sticking with hockey, the Montreal Canadiens, just iconic. They haven't changed it. It's great. It's classic.
Okay. Wow. No overlap with you. So my number one is the Houston Rockets. I do like that. That it's like the H and the R that are kind of like matrixy,
yeah,
vampire-ish. I don't know.
Yeah, you have the R sitting in. Where's the H? Oh, I guess the H is within the R. You're saying.
Let me see what you're looking at.
The blue, just.
Yeah, yeah. There's another form of it too, but I do kind of like that. Number two, Mike, I thought this might be on your list, was the Vegas Golden Knights. I do like their logo. I think it's pretty cool. It's like got that like 300 back with your shield or on.
Yeah, yeah.
Number three, shocker. I love the Birds logo.
I had them on my – they're a backup.
They
for
were
me.
A backup.
Yeah, they're not a backup.
I like them,
they're
too.
They're a solid
number. I agree.
Number four, and it's probably just taking me back to my childhood. I mean, I like the Bulls logo. I think it's a classic Jordan, best basketball player of all time. Just think it just sticks with me. And then number five, I don't hate this. I don't know why I like it, but I do like the Atlanta Falcons. That Falcon that they have, it's kind of sharp to me.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good.
All right. Well, we'll show up big time for our next
episode. Yeah. Next episode is 100. Thanks for listening.
See ya.